Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. Welcome to human anatomy class. We're going to get into joints today, and today is September 28th. Let's take a look at the schedule real quick and see what the next exam is going to be. All right, so today is the 28th. 1 week from today, we're going to have a lecture on muscles, but 2 weeks from today is exam number two. All right, exam number two on chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And notice, that same week we have practicums. So those of you that have lab on Monday will have a lecture exam and a practicum, either before or after the lecture, depending on when your lab is. All right, so don't get caught short of time to study for both of those. At least there is a lot of good overlap between the practicum and the lecture material. So it might be actually helpful to have a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day. I'm not really sure. All right, and then the very last day, the Wednesday labs will have a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day. So we switch back and forth. Lecture exam number three doesn't occur on a week that we have a practicum, so that one does not matter. Okay, joints, that's what we're going to get in today. I don't think I finished everything in appendicular skeleton yet, but we were talking about that last time. Who's got a question regarding appendicular skeleton? Anybody have a question for appendicular skeleton? You should have a picture in your mind of what bones those are, and what bones are those? The appendicular skeleton, right? Skeleton means bones. Your limbs, that's right. Yeah, like your upper limb, your lower limb, okay? And also don't forget the girdles, right? So here is a girdle. It pretty much surrounds your thoracic cavity, made up of the clavicle and scapula, right? Here's a nice subscapular fossa on the anterior side of the scapula, which we normally don't see because it's deep, because it's on your back. Okay, so what girdle does the clavicle and scapula form when they're put together? Anybody know what girdle? Yeah, pectoral girdle. What about the girdle that attaches your lower appendage to your axial skeleton? What's that one? The pelvic girdle. And I don't have a picture of that right at the moment. Okay. So a nice clavicle. One end is flat, like a blade, and the other looks like the opening of a trumpet or a bugle. Which one is flat? Okay. The one that's flat is actually the acromial end. So you got to get to lab, and so this picture is misleading. Right? Both ends look very similar, but the acromial end is very flat, kind of looks like a knife blade. This one here is nice and round if you look at the tip. All right? That's about the only thing that you have to know about the clavicle. Scapula's got a bunch of different pieces to it, and who knows how many fossa are on the scapula that you have to know about? Yeah, four, exactly right. Right, here's the subscapular. All right, but don't forget there's the supraspinous and then the infraspinous and then also the glenoid cavity, and you could call glenoid cavity glenoid fossa if you wanted to. All right, so that is, okay, humerus. What bone is this? What part of the body is this? The humerus is found in it's your upper appendage, all right, that's a hint. But what part of your upper appendage?
Forearm.
Okay, I don't like forearm necessarily, but you're close. You're really close. Between your shoulder and your elbow is your arm in particular, all right? So the humerus is a bone in your arm, and you can see the head of the humerus, and which way is the head of the humerus pointing? Medial or lateral? Medial or lateral? Okay, you got to know that. That's going to be medial, right? And so if we go all the way down on the diaphysis, the shaft mid-diaphysis, and laterally, we have the deltoid tuberosity. That's where the deltoid muscle inserts into. But what I'm getting to, finally, all the way down here at the distal epiphysis, we have some smooth condylar surfaces. And how many are there on this distal epiphysis of the humerus? How many condylar surfaces are there? That's a kind of a tricky question. Okay. How many names do you see on this illustration? Okay, I see capitulum and I see trochlea. So there are two. There are two condylar surfaces. These are smooth surfaces for articulation. All right, so if there are two condylar surfaces, can you take a guess how many bones are in the forearm? Yeah, there are two, right? And so each one will articulate with one of these surfaces, either the capitulum or the trochlea. And the capitulum here is going to be what, medial or lateral? Lateral, because here's your landmark, right? Here's the head of the humerus, so capitulum is lateral. The trochlea is medial. That's pretty much what I wanted to show you about that. So, in the forearm, what bone articulates with the capitulum? Oh, that could be an exam question, multiple choice. What bone articulates with the capitulum? In the radius, because that's lateral, which means what articulates with the trochlea? The ulna, that's right. And there's a hook on the ulna that we call the trochlear notch that fits right around the trochlea. Okay, and look at this. Here's the head of the radius articulating with the capitulum. Here's the coronoid process, and then behind it is the olecranon process, and it forms a little hook, right? And we call that hook the trochlear notch that fits right on top of the trochlea here. When you get to lab, put those bones together. Oh, there's that nice olecranon process. That's the bone that you hit on your elbow when you bang into something. Indeed, two bones, radius and ulna, starting laterally, going to medially. We're going to talk about joints today. Here is a joint between the radius and ulna, and it's filled with an interosseous membrane. It stabilizes these two bones, but does not prevent motion. It allows for motion of these two bones. There's also an articulation at the head of the radius, which I see here, and the head of the ulna, which is the distal epiphysis on both of these bones. Okay, so there's going to be a notch in the ulna that accepts the head of the radius. What are we going to call that notch on the ulna? The radial notch. Remember, we name it after the bone that touches right there, but not the name of the bone that it's on. This notch is on the ulna, but we want to call it the radial notch because the radius touches there. There's also going to be a notch on the distal epiphysis of the radius, and what would we call this notch? Not by the name of the bone that it's on, but by the name of the bone that's touching right there, and that's the ulna. So that's going to be the ulnar notch on the radius. All right, I'm going through all this stuff. Oh, here are some notches, right? Nice ulnar notch. If I go back one, here is the radial notch on the ulna. Here's that trochlear notch that fits around the trochlea, right? And that's the medial articular surface. All right, when we get to the hands, okay, there are three major groups of bones. These right here that make up the wrist, you have to know these as carpals. Bones that make up the hand, you're going to know these as metacarpals. And then bones that make up the digits or the fingers are called phalanges. So that's where I want to start to finish up the lower appendage. All right, and don't forget, we name these bones, whether it's in a digit or the hand, starting with the thumb. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Little finger is number 5. And as far as the phalanges goes, most of them have three bones. So you got a distal, middle, and proximal phalanx. And would you want to call this one right here, where I have the cursor hovering, would we want to call this the medial one? No, because medial means toward midline, and that's not the significant concept that we want to deal with here. We want to say, but either closer or farther away from this metacarpal. So that's the middle one, right? Middle, it's in the middle, not medial or lateral. All right, we talked about that last time. We talked about the pelvis in lab quite a bit. I think we talked about the femur, okay? So where do we find the femur? What part of your body do we find a femur? Your leg, but that wouldn't be quite right. Okay, it is your thigh. Between your hip and your knee is your thigh. So the femur is a thigh bone. And here are bones of the leg. Between your knee and your ankle is your leg. And how many bones do you see there? Yeah, there are two. We're going to get down to that location really fast. Okay, so just like the humerus, the head of the femur is medial. So Here we see the medial epicondyle. That's for muscle attachment. Here's the lateral epicondyle. This is going to be really important because here's a condylar surface, right? And is this one where I have the cursor, the medial or lateral condylar surface, smooth surface for making the knee joint? Okay, because look, here is the head of the femur, so that's medial. Here is lateral. When we get to the knee, we're going to really learn a lot about the knee joint, and we're going to have to know medial and lateral really well. So this is a good place to start, okay, just by looking at the head of the femur and knowing which surface on this distal epiphysis is medial or lateral. All right, the two bones in the leg are the tibia and fibula. And sometimes this is really confusing for students to remember which one is medial and which one is lateral because I don't see a landmark here, right? You just have to memorize this, and you should memorize that the tibia is medial and the fibula is lateral. Fibula, tibia, and maybe it's, try this. There is an L in fibula. There's no L in tibia. What is, so there's an L in fibula. What other word has an L in it that might match up for you? Lateral. Yeah, that might help. I never saw that before, but that might help, or that might be just as easy to forget. I'm not really sure. Okay, so that's lateral. But don't forget, you walked in here with the answer key attached to your body, right? And you can palpate your leg, and you feel a pretty big bone, right? That's medial, and that's the tibia, and this sharp crest or anterior border is poking out anteriorly, and you can feel that with your fingertips as well. You don't have a lot of muscle medially, so you can feel this tibia, but if you try to palpate the fibula, there's no way you can palpate it because it's buried underneath a lot of muscle, so you can't feel it, but you can feel the tibia. All right, so there are some condylar surfaces on the tibia over here and over here. So this would be the medial condyle. Here's the lateral condyle for articulating with the femur. I see a couple bony prominences down by the ankle, and you can feel these ankle bones really nice and easy as well. Right, they stick out on either side. These things are called, or one of them is a malleolus. Right? Otherwise, they're called malleoli. One is medial and one is lateral. So if we're looking at the tibia, I see a malleolus. Is that going to be the medial or lateral malleolus? Medial, because tibia is medial. And then the lateral malleolus is on the fibula. All right? And those are important because there are a number of tendons that circulate around or underneath these malleoli and muscles attached to them. They're pretty important pieces. One other thing on the tibia that's really important to know is this rough raised area, right, on the anterior part of the tibia. And it's a process. So what's the function of this tibial tuberosity? Muscle attachment, right? Anytime you think of process, that is a raised area on a bone that's rough, just think of muscle attachment. Probably some of the most powerful muscles in your body attached right here. And those muscles are in your anterior thigh. There's four of them called the quadriceps that attach right here. Okay. All right, so here is an eminence between the condyles on the tibia. We call this the intercondylar eminence. There's some important ligaments that attach in the knee, right in this location, which we're going to see in the next chapter. Is anybody familiar with any ligaments that we find in a knee? ACL. ACL stands for anterior cruciate ligament. So I like ACL. That's perfect. Anybody know another one besides ACL? Okay. So there's an anterior cruciate. There's a posterior cruciate. And then there are collateral ligaments as well, right? But we're mostly familiar with the cruciate ligaments. And the cruciate ligaments attach right here, right smack between the medial and lateral condyles of the tibia. So you'll see how that knee gets put together pretty nicely. Okay. All right, so those are the bones of the leg. We're going to move down to the foot. And let's go back to the hand just for a second. How many groups of bones do you have distal to your forearm? How many groups of bones? 3. The first group is called carpals. The second group is called metacarpals. And then the third group are called phalanges, right? So carpals make up the wrist, metacarpals make up the hand, phalanges make up those digits. Well, the foot is arranged pretty much the same way. You have ankle bones, and there are 8 of them, but we're not going to call these carpals because those are in your wrist. That'd be really confusing. These things here are what we call tarsals. Tarsals make up ankle bones, right? And then the bones of the foot itself, the proper bones of the foot, these are called metatarsals, right? And then the bones that make up the digits are phalanges as well. One is called a phalanx. Right, and just like in the hand, how do we start numbering these digits? Where do we start? Which one is digit number 1 in the hand? The thumb. Like, yeah. Think of it like if you're hitchhiking, you put your number 1 digit up like that. And in the foot, it's going to be the great toe or big toe is going to be number 1, all the way down to the little toe right here, which is number 5. And the phalanges have the same architecture as in the hand. The great toe only has 2, right? But all the other digits have 3. Distal, middle, proximal, phalanx. And then you would have to know the name. When you get to lab, okay, when you get to lab, make sure you can tell the difference between a hand and a foot. I forgot to point that out to you guys this morning, right? It seems like it's easy to do, all right? But I think it's just as easy for some people to mix it up. There are a couple bones that are tarsals that I want you to know, right? So we know all these, how to name all these phalanges and all these metatarsals. There are 2 tarsals I want you to know. When you strike the ground with your heel, you're striking the ground with the calcaneus, which is the biggest, strongest bone of your ankle. And then right above it is the talus. So these are the 2 I want you to know. And if we look at a superior view, here is the talus. This talus, right, fits in right between the malleoli of the fibula and tibia. It fits right in there, really nice and perfect fit. Okay, and then here is that calcaneus. So we got talus and calcaneus. So that's pretty much it for the foot, unless I have a nice x-ray to show. I don't. Maybe I'll go back real fast this way. A couple more. All right, so the talus fits in right here, kind of a nice boxy square bone. It fits in right between the lateral and medial malleolus of the tibia and fibula. Fits right in here. Okay. All right, so who's got a question about this chapter? I'm just seeing if there's anything else I want to mention. Probably not. All right, know the 2 girdles. What are the 2 girdles? Pectoral and pelvic girdle. Now you should know what bones make that up. So here is a really good, tough question. What bones make up the os coxae? What bones? How many? Well, tell you what. How many bones make up an os coxae first? That's a hip bone, right? Os coxae is a hip bone? 3. I like those 3. Anybody know the names? Give me the name of one of them. Ilium. Ischium. One more. Pubis. Yeah. Where do we find the pubis or pubic bone? If we're going to pick a direction, anterior, posterior, superior, inferior. Okay, the pubic bone. Probably the best way to think of the pubic bone is anterior. Anterior. Pubic bone is most anterior. Which one is the most superior? Ilium. Which one is the most inferior? Ischium. Yeah, that's so you should have that picture in your mind as well. All right, so that's it for the appendicular skeleton. Make sure you know the difference between a thigh and a leg and an arm and forearm. Yeah, question.
So for a lecture exam, it's mostly identification of the bone?
Oh, for a lecture exam? I don't know what I have on the test. Probably I'll make it up. But when I go make the test up, I print out a copy of the exam study guide for that chapter. And then I just pay attention to all those questions there. So certainly there are exam figures, but there are also questions as well at the end of the chapter and practice questions that are online too. Okay, so it's easy for me to say what's on the exam, right? And that makes it easy for me to make up an exam too, because then I'm telling you exactly what to focus on and what to study. Okay, so the exam study guides. How would you study for a practicum? What's your best resource for a practicum? The lab manual is the answer key for the practicum, right? And the exam study guide is the answer key for the lecture exam. Okay, well, I'm going to put these bones away, and we're going to move on to joints. And here are some joints. And I'm going to put that away, like so. Okay, this chapter, right, chapter 9, has a lot of anatomy in it, and that's good because this is an anatomy class, but it also has some physiology associated with it. But that's okay, because when you talk about the shape of something, you're really talking about the function of something anyway, right? So we're going to make a really nice association between structure and function in this particular chapter. So, how do we classify a joint? There are a number of different ways. We can classify it by primarily its structure, or we can classify joints primarily by what kind of motion it produces, or the function. And you're going to see that there's a relationship between these two different classifications. All right, so what the heck is an articulation? Articulation is a joint between two bones that move. Right, and as a matter of fact, there are some joints that don't move at all, like a suture is a joint, so it's a bone-to-bone connection, and that suture doesn't even move at all. So a good definition of an articulation is a site where two or more bones, come together. Some joints give the skeleton a lot of mobility, other joints hold bones together. So we can classify these bones, either by their structure or by their function. So let's take a look at some of these classifications. So here we have structural. We got fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. What kind of fiber is important for a fibrous joint? It's going to be a strong fiber. Collagen. Yeah, it's going to be collagen. Nice. Cartilaginous joints have a lot of hyaline cartilage in them, right? Or articular cartilage. And a synovial joint has got a bunch of pieces that we're going to look at. And that's going to be nice to know something about a synovial joint. All right, let's look at some fibrous joints. So this is by what? This is a structural classification. Here are some joints between those flat bones of the skull. We call these sutures. And you had to know these already. These are immovable joints. But nonetheless, it's a fibrous joint. So a suture is a fibrous joint because there's a lot of collagen, right? Dense fibrous connective tissue that holds these bony plates together. Right? Suture would be one good example of a fibrous joint. Also, a syndesmosis. And a syndesmosis is a joint where two bones are held together with a ligament. And I see it right here, right at the distal end of the tibia and fibula. There is a ligament. You don't have to know the name of this ligament. In this particular case, it's kind of a lot like a suture because it stabilizes the joint between the tibia and fibula so that it doesn't move. It's not supposed to move very much at all. Maybe a little bit more than a suture, but still not very much. Okay, so a syndesmosis is a lot like a suture, but they're a little bit longer. These collagen fibers are longer. Another kind of fibrous joint is a joint between a tooth, right, on either the maxilla or mandible. Looks like this one is from a mandible. So here you see the root of a tooth going way back down. So what does the root of the tooth fit into? Okay, here is the margin. Here's the margin of an alveolus. But this little hole is what we call the alveolus, right? So the root of a tooth fits into an alveolus, and the edge of that alveolus is the alveolar margin. So here is an alveolus, and look, here is a ligament, all this collagen tissue going from these alveolar processes over to the root of the tooth, and that holds that tooth really nice and secure in the alveolus. Now, is this a movable or an immovable joint? Go ahead. It's an immovable joint. Yeah, did you just go ahead and draw a tooth and see if you can get it to move around? Does it move around? Except when you're going to lose a tooth, right, when you go from baby teeth to deciduous tooth, then these ligaments right here dissolve away and the tooth pops out. And then a new one grows back in that location. So these ligaments are called periodontal ligaments. Peri means surrounding, and dentitia are teeth. So it's just a ligament that completely surrounds the tooth. So that's another kind of fibrous joint. All right, synchondrosis. These are cartilaginous joints. And cartilaginous joints are not as strong as fibrous joints. They might provide for some motion, a little bit of motion, depending on exactly which kind of joint it is. Others should not be moved. All right, and when you see this term, chondro, what should you think of chondro here? Yeah, you should think of cartilage, right? Like a chondrocyte is a bone that is a cell that lives in cartilage. Synchondrosis is a good example. Here is that epiphyseal plate. That epiphyseal plate is made out of cartilage, and another name for epiphyseal plate is a growth plate. This is where bones grow in length from, right? There's also, so this is the proximal one. There's also one on the distal end of this bone. Anybody recognize this bone right here? How would I recognize this? Okay, humerus. I like that. All right, somebody said humerus. And so here is the intertubercular groove. So here's a greater tubercle. Here's a lesser tubercle. Here's the head of the humerus covered with hyaline cartilage. Here's the anatomic neck. Here's the surgical neck, just to give you a little bit of a reference. So this growth plate does not have a lot of collagen. It has hyaline cartilage, so it's not very strong. And that's why it's easy to damage these growth plates in young individuals, either due to twisting, right, or compression. And I suppose it could even pull apart, even tension can damage this joint, and then the bone won't grow in length anymore after it's damaged, or it's going to not grow as fast as the other appendage on the other side of your body. Here is another kind of synchondrosis. This is a joint between the first rib and the manubrium, and which is a part of the sternum, right? So that's also a synchondrosis. It's slightly movable. It's just slightly movable. Helps with respiration, helps with some arm motions, but basically, mostly that's a very stable kind of joint. All right, so synchondrosis. So what have we looked at so far? Fibrous, right, and one kind of cartilaginous. Some cartilaginous joints are really strong because they have a lot of collagen in them. Those are what we're going to call a symphysis. So symphysis is a kind of cartilaginous joint, but it has a lot more collagen. An intervertebral disc is a symphysis. It's strong because it supports body weight. It's between the bodies of the vertebrae. And also, the pubic symphysis. This is a very strong joint between the ends of the pubic bone that come together. And where do we find that pubic bone once again in one word? Anterior, yeah, it's anterior, right? It's pubic symphysis. That's a pretty strong joint, has a lot of collagen, except during childbirth, then this joint dissolves away to some degree so that the pubic bones can separate, enlarging the birth canal. Okay, I think I mentioned that before. So what were the kinds of cartilaginous joints? We have synchondrosis. That's pretty easy because chondro's in the term, right? And then symphysis, which has fibrocartilage, right? And that was it. Okay, synchondrosis and symphysis. All right, so then that takes us to synovial. And a synovial joint has a number of pieces to it. It's a little bit more complicated than a fibrous or a cartilaginous joint, but these are probably going to be your most favorite joints. So let's take a look at these. I see two bones. Here's the proximal bone, here's the distal bone. Separating them is this articulation. And the synovial joint has all of these pieces. The ends of the bone are covered with hyaline cartilage. Right here and right here. Right? Hyaline cartilage is not very strong, but it's smooth and slippery, and it's slightly compressible. That protects the ends of the bone so that when they move against each other, they don't wear each other away. This hyaline cartilage is receiving lubrication all the time from this fluid that's in the cavity between these two bones, right? And we call this synovial fluid because this is a synovial joint. Synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane. Synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid into this joint cavity, and that synovial fluid helps nourish these cells in the hyaline cartilage. What do we call the cells in hyaline cartilage? Chondrocytes, that's right. All right, so it's not a vascular supply, it's not a blood supply, it's just synovial fluid. So it doesn't bring a lot of oxygen and nutrients into the synovial cavity, but some to keep those cells alive. But if this cartilage is damaged, it doesn't have a tendency to grow back because it's avascular. All right, so the synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid into the cavity, nourishes the hyaline cartilage. That synovial membrane is really weak, so it's got to have some support. And that support is what we call the fibrous capsule. The fibrous capsule, which has a lot of collagen, and it goes all the way from the proximal to the distal bone, encircles these two bones, and it provides a very strong background, right, for the synovial membrane, which is secreting synovial fluid. And if we put the fibrous capsule together with the synovial membrane, which is what I see right here, that's what we call the articular capsule. So the articular capsule has these two divisions, one really strong, right, and then the other one relatively weak, but it's important because it secretes synovial fluid into this cavity. There can also be, and there usually are, ligaments that go from the proximal to the distal bone, further stabilizing the joint, right, and protecting the synovial cavity, and that's a ligament. Because remember, what is a ligament? It's a connection between two bones, right? It's a bone-to-bone connection. What's a bone-to-muscle connection called? That's a tendon, right? So here is a nice ligament because I see a couple bones. All right, so this is a synovial joint. And a synovial joint, I said, was probably going to be your favorite because it's movable. It's a freely movable joint. So when you move your skeleton around, bend some bones, or bend bones around each other, that's a synovial joint that is allowing that kind of function. All right, so we just got done looking at a classification of joints by their structure. Right, some have a lot of collagen, those are called fibrous. Some have a lot of cartilage in them, those are called cartilaginous. And then a synovial has all of these other pieces. It's a little bit more complicated, but what does a synovial joint give your body? The ability to move your skeleton, right? It's a nice movable joint. So it's got to have all these other extra kind of pieces to it. All right, and that is an exam figure. So make sure you see the and can be able to distinguish these different layers in a synovial joint. Okay, let's talk about joints in terms of their functional classification. Right, a synarthrosis is immovable. We've looked at a suture already. That's a synarthrosis, right? It doesn't have anything to do with the structure of this particular term. It just means immovable. There's an amphiarthrosis. Amphiarthrosis is slightly movable, like those intervertebral discs. It allows you to rotate your back a little bit, bend forward and backwards a little bit. Okay, so that's only a slight motion. That's an amphiarthrosis. And a diarthrosis is a joint that's freely movable. Right? You can... freely movable in the sense that the motion that's allowed is determined by the shape of the bones that come together right there. So not all joints perform the same kind of motion, right? But a diarthrosis, right, is freely movable. So how are you going to remember, okay, the classification, the functional classification? Well, if you take the first letter of each of these words, that spells another word. And in this particular case, it makes sense. And what does that spell out? Sad. That should actually make you happy because this is easy to know, right? Synarthrosis is immovable. What is the freely movable? The last letter, the D in sad, and then in between, the A for amphiarthrosis, those are slightly movable joints. All right, so you probably run into a couple of questions on these classifications of joints. By their function. Okay, fibrous joints. Oh wow, we kind of talked about this already. Fibrous joints. I tell you what, let's go back. Fibrous joints. Got them all here on this slide. We have a suture, right? Fibrous joint. These are immovable, All right, so what's the function of a suture? What should you be thinking when I say function? What should you be thinking of? You're happy, but the word is sad, right? So the suture right here is immovable. This is a synarthrosis, right? Synarthrosis, immovable. See this little F equals? That's a little math lingo right there. Function of this is, right, immovable. Syndesmosis, right? So here is a syndesmosis between the stabilizing ligament between the tibia and fibula. Sometimes it's immovable. And remember that interosseous membrane between the ulna and radius, or along the whole length of the tibia and fibula, right? That's a diarthrosis. It stabilizes the joint, but doesn't prevent, okay, the motion. Diarthrosis, like we can move the palms of our hand so that the palms face posteriorly, or so that our palms face anteriorly, the joint between the radius and the ulna is moving without restriction. All right, and then that gamphosis right here, and this is a synarthrosis because your teeth don't move around inside your jaw bones at all. Cartilaginous, we looked at a couple kinds of cartilaginous joints. A synchondrosis, where's a synchondrosis at? Ah, synchondrosis, like this epiphyseal plate, right, and between the first rib and the manubrium. That's what it said right here. And these joints, right, this epiphyseal plate should not undergo any kind of motion. It's not very strong, and if motion does occur at this joint, then that damages the epiphyseal plate. Symphysis, fibrocartilage, slightly movable. Okay, what's the term for a slightly movable joint? You got SAD. Slightly movable is amphiarthrosis, right? And like the intervertebral discs, that's a really good example of a slightly movable kind of joint. All right, and then the last kind, okay, synovial. And a synovial is a joint, it's a structural classification, and it's got a number of different pieces. Right. Articular cartilage. Where do we find articular cartilage on a synovial joint? Articular cartilage. And what kind of cartilage is that? It's hyaline cartilage. And where do you find it? It covers the ends or the tips of the bones, right? Both bones that come together to form a joint. That's articular cartilage. So articular cartilage and hyaline cartilage, the same thing. Right? People would know all the time. The joint cavity is the space between the bones, right? And what is in that joint cavity? Synovial fluid, right? That helps nourish and lubricate and maintain the hyaline cartilage. And where does the synovial fluid come from? The synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid. It just weeps out of this membrane into the cavity, and then it's resorbed as well. Right? And let's see, now what gives some strength to this joint? What gives some, so the synovial membrane is too weak. It doesn't really stabilize a joint, hardly protects the joint cavity. But what do we have? The fibrous capsule, a lot of collagen. Remember, that's that strong fiber. And if we take the fibrous capsule with the synovial membrane, put them together, you get the articular capsule, which is strong. Right, but it also produces synovial fluid. And then we have some reinforcing ligaments that span the joint. We're going to have to know a couple names of some of those ligaments. You might have some nerves and some blood vessels in a joint. I don't have them, they're not shown on this particular illustration. Right? But you can also have bursa or tendon sheets. And we haven't talked about a bursa or a tendon sheet yet. But the way that we think of a bursa or a tendon sheath is by our understanding of a synovial joint, right? So a bursa and a tendon sheath will have the similar kind of features right here. It will have synovial fluid secreted by a synovial membrane, and that's all going to be surrounded by a fibrous capsule, right? Either a tendon sheath or a bursa, Well, let's see where some of these things are. All right, so here is the humerus. And I see this depression right here. Who knows the name of this depression? Okay, that's the glenoid fossa. Somebody knew it back there, glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. Right, and it looks pretty flat to me. Right, there's a little bit of a depression, not very much. Looks certainly doesn't look like a bowl, looks more like a plate. Okay, and the head of the humerus fits right into there. And we can see all the different pieces of this nice synovial joint. And then, what bone is this up over here? That's the scapula once again, right? But now here is the acromion process. And let's take a look at this area between the head of the humerus and the acromion process. So that acromion process is a really big, strong bone. If the head of the humerus were to bounce up against it, rub up against it, right, they would grind each other away very, very easily. So there's something that your body has that protects these two bones, and it is called a bursa. And it's underneath the acromion process, so we call that the subacromial bursa. And a bursa you should think of as a pillow. It's not really attached to anything, or it's attached very weakly. And it has a synovial membrane, and it has a fibrous capsule, and it's inserted between a muscle and some bones. When a muscle contracts, it can really bang up against a bone, and that bursa is going to prevent inflammation. Or some bursa are included between two bones, like the acromion process and the head of the humerus, right? Because when you contract muscles of the humerus, it might jab it up into the acromion process and cause inflammation. This bursa right here will prevent that inflammation from occurring in most cases. Also, when you move your arm, right, and this bursa can slide back and forth, right? Can you see it like rolling within the shoulder joint? So that's another function that helps prevent inflammation of the shoulder joint. So this looks like, can you see this looks like a little bit of a pillow right here with synovial fluid on the inside, synovial membrane, fibrous capsule that is inserted between a muscle and some bones, or a muscle and a ligament, or between two bones. All right, so this is the subacromial bursa. Here is a tendon. Let's move on to the next topic. Here's a tendon. From the biceps, and you all know where your biceps is. We haven't talked about it yet, but that's in your anterior arm. There's a tendon that comes up off the biceps, and it goes completely over the head of the humerus and inserts into the scapula right above the glenoid fossa. And you had to know the name of this thing in lab. Well, today you did. So those of you that had lab this morning, anybody know what this area right above the glenoid fossa is called? It's called the supraglenoid tubercle. So a tubercle is a very small kind of process, and that's what this long head of the biceps brachii inserts into. So this tendon goes all the way over the head of the humerus, and it moves around a lot when you use your biceps. So not only is there a bursa that protects this tendon, right, from inflammation, and these bones from inflammation, but there's also a pillow that wraps around it. And basically it's like a synovial capsule. There's synovial fluid in it. There's a synovial membrane and a fibrous capsule, and it surrounds this tendon, preventing inflammation when the biceps contracts. All of a sudden there's a lot of tension on this tendon, and it's going to slap or bounce up against all these other pieces of the shoulder, and it's this tendon sheath that reduces inflammation. So a tendon sheath is a lot like a bursa, except it does what? It wraps itself around a tendon. What else do I see on this shoulder joint? I don't think this is in your notes, but let's take a look at this glenoid fossa once again. It looks kind of shallow. It's not quite flat. There's a little depression, so it is a fossa. There's something that makes this glenoid fossa a little bit deeper, and it's called a labrum. And I see one here, and I see one here, right? And It completely encircles the glenoid fossa, so this is called the glenoid labrum. It's not bone, so it's not very strong, right? It's just fibrous tissue, and that helps increase the depth of the glenoid fossa, so that helps stabilize the joint. But it's not very strong, which means what? It can be damaged pretty easily. It's very easy to rip a glenoid labrum, right? Some athletes have that kind of problem. If you're a baseball pitcher, if this labrum ever rips or tears, then that's pretty much the end of your career as a baseball player when that happens. Okay, it can be repaired, but you just won't have the same kind of dexterity and strength at that shoulder joint. All right, so can you see how this glenoid labrum makes the depth of the glenoid fossa just a little bit deeper? That makes the joint a little bit stronger. Okay, so that is shoulder joint. And you can see that nice bursa. Okay, some synovial joints have an additional piece, right? And I don't have it on this picture right here, but some joints have another piece of fibrocartilage between the two ends of the bones that protect these two bones, right? And that's called an articular disc. You're probably familiar with the articular disc in the knee. You've probably heard of them before. They're called menisci. There's a medial meniscus and a lateral meniscus, right? And that is what we call an articular disc. There are some other joints that have an articular disc. Let me see if I can find another joint that has an articular disc. Ah, okay. Here it is between the clavicle and the manubrium. So here is the articular disc, that's fibrocartilage. There is an articular disc in the TMJ. What's that TMJ called again? Temporomandibular joint. So here is the mandible, here's the mandibular condyle, right? And then here's the mandibular fossa that the condyle fits up into. And you can see there's synovial, there's a joint cavity right up against the mandible. There's a joint cavity in the mandibular fossa, and separating them is this articular disc. And this articular disc can be damaged, just like you're aware that some people can damage their knee meniscus. And I suppose this TMJ can actually, if it's damaged, it can lock in place, just like a knee can lock into place. And the person, what kind of clinician would know most about this joint right here? Okay, you could have like somebody that knows something about bones, like an orthopedist, family practice, what kind of a podiatrist, works on your feet. Okay, what kind of physician would know most about this particular joint? That would be a dentist. Yeah, because they deal with these problems all the time. And your dental hygienist might even ask you some questions and move your mandible around if you have a good dental examination, and ask about how this joint is performing for you, because it can cause all kinds of really strange problems. Okay. Oh, there's something I forgot to mention. And that has to do with these bursa and tendon sheaths. Where was that bursa at? Oh, here's a bursa, right between the head of the humerus and the acromion process. Right here's that subacromial bursa. So their job is to prevent inflammation when these bones move up against each other. And sometimes they bang up against each other depending on how you use a particular muscle. But every once in a while, these things, right, get swollen and irritated and inflamed because this joint has been used too much or maybe inappropriately. So here is a bursa, and if it becomes inflamed, right, what do we call that condition? That would be bursitis, right? So this little bursa starts to swell up and it then becomes inflamed. And since it swells up, whenever you move the humerus, right, it moves around some more and it gets more inflamed, swells up some more. You move your arm, that increases the inflammation, it swells up some more. So you can see that's kind of, that situation feeds on itself and it produces a very inflamed kind of bursa. And you can get these in your hip or your shoulder, even in your feet, right? Bursitis. And usually rest is a good way to cure that. All right, now this is going to be a good part of anatomy because I've been really waiting to get to this part because we get to talk about motions that your body can go through. And I've tried to use some of this terminology before, but you guys didn't know what it was. So now we're going to go over it so we can actually use this. So a lot of times in anatomy, the class gets easier once you learn a certain amount of material because you can use the anatomic language to make things really nice and simple. All right, so let's look at some motions. Okay, motions. In your wrist, right, there's a gliding motion. These bones are pretty flat up against each other right here. So they can glide over each other, not very long distances, but short distances, right? Either right to left, anterior to posterior. That's a gliding kind of motion. Okay, here is something called flexion and extension. These are antagonistic motions. And where do I want to start talking about flexion and extension? How about, oh, let's look at the knee. This is a good place to start talking about flexion and extension. Okay, so when you're in anatomic position, here's your thigh, and then directly below it is your leg. This forms a nice straight line when you're standing in an anatomic position. When you move the joint, right, here is the knee joint, and if you lift your heel up off the ground and bring it up off the ground, as I see right here, what happens to this angle between the thigh and the leg? So here, what's the angle between the thigh and the leg right here? Just a straight line. It is 180 degrees, right? Then it would be 360 if we go all the way around. So if we lift the heel up off the ground to this location, okay, now what angle do we have right here? 90 degrees, right? So whenever you decrease the angle between two bones, like going from 180 degrees to 90 degrees, decreasing the angle is called flexion. That's a really good definition to know. Decreasing the angle is flexion. And then if we want to increase this angle once again, like bringing the foot back down by the side, that is what we call extension. So extension increases the angle, flexion decreases the angle. We can do the same thing for the hip. All right, so here is the hip joint, and here's a person in anatomic position, and what's the angle between the torso and the thigh going across the hip right here? Okay, it's 180 degrees, just like the knee joint, right? So it's 180 degrees. Can we bend this hip? Can you bend at the hip? Yes, you can. And how can you do that? Well, I'll demonstrate that for you. All right, so here we have a hip, right? Here's your thigh, here's your torso. How can we bend at the hip? I'll hold on to something. So we can bend the hip like this, right? And then I can move it back down. So when I go like this, is that increasing or decreasing the angle? It's decreasing the angle. Here's 180, right? Here's 90. So what do we call that at the hip? When I go like that, that's flexion. Perfect. And what do we call the motion that I just did, going from 90 to 180? That's extension, right? So flexion and extension at the hip. The hip could do something kind of special that the knee should never do, okay? I can actually put my leg behind me, all right? So going from flexed, okay, extended, this motion is called hyperextension, right? So the angle is decreasing on the other side of my body. Hyperextension. Some joints can hyperextend very nicely. Others can't. Things will break if you hyperextend. All right, so at the wrist, right, you can. What is this motion here at the wrist? That's flexion because I've decreased that angle. Here is extension. And can the wrist hyperextend? Look at that. Yes, it can pretty easily. Right? So here is flexion, extension, hyperextension. Most wrists can do that. Now what about a joint between phalanges? Right? I can flex, I can extend. What about hyperextension? No, don't try that. Okay, don't do that one. Okay, same thing for the knee. What is this motion here at the knee? Flexion, and this is? Extension, and can I hyperextend? No, you cannot. Okay, just because the shape of the bones, the shape of the joint, which we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, so I kind of went on and on and on about flexion and extension because there's one joint where flexion and extension is hard to see according to those general rules, and that is at the shoulder. All right, so here's the shoulder. I'm in anatomic position right now, and when I move my arm anteriorly like this, I don't see an angle changing, really. All right, but nonetheless, it has a nice anatomic definition. When I bring my arm back down by my side, again, it's hard for me to picture an angle that's changing. Right? So when you go from anatomic position to raising your hand at the shoulder, that's what we call flexion, believe it or not. Right? So here is flexion at the shoulder, and then so bringing my hand back down to my side. What's that? Don't know how that happened. Is that still there? Yeah, okay. I thought maybe I lost the battery. No. Okay, so what motion is this? Flexion, and then bringing my arm back down to the side is extension, and then what about that? Hyperextension. So you can hyperextend at the shoulder, no problem. All right, so how are you going to remember that this is flexion at the shoulder because there's no good rule? Here's how I remember it. So here you have your shoulder. Here's your hip. Think of it as being your hip. All right, so at your hip, what do we call that? Flexion. Here's extension. All right, and let's look at the shoulder. This is flexion. Here is extension. Here is hyperextension. So just think of the hip to understand how we name the motion at the shoulder. Okay, so, but flexion, usually we decrease the angle. For flexion, we increase, and then some joints we can even hyperextend. All right, here is another one. All right, your vertebral column. When you're in anatomic position, it forms a nice straight 180 degree line, and if we decrease the angle by bending forward, that is flexion of the vertebral column, and then extension of the vertebral column, and then maybe you can hyperextend a little bit, okay, of the vertebral column. That's a good one to know, flexion and extension of the vertebral column. And here is flexion and extension of the cervical spine, right? So flexion is bending your head forward, bringing your head back up is extension, and you can hyperextend a little bit of the cervical region. Okay, so that's flexion, extension. Okay, a couple other motions. In anatomic position, okay, if you move your arm up and stay in the same plane, don't move it anterior or posterior, just stay in the same plane. When you move your arms away from your body, we call that abduction, A-B, abduction. When you bring your arms back down, that's called adduction. So if you're adding your arms back to your body, right, that's adduction. You can do the same thing at your hips, right? Abduction, adduction. And we're going to name muscles with these different motions, so it's a really good idea to know a lot about. There's flexors and adductors, abductors. All right, so what did we call this motion? Abduction. That's right. There's a muscle that's really important for doing that. It's called the deltoid muscle right here. So the deltoid is an abductor, right? Not an adductor. There's some really powerful muscles on the medial part of your thighs that are always pulling your feet together. They're really strong muscles. Those are all adductors, because if all of a sudden your legs split apart, what will happen? Well, yeah, you just fall on your butt, right? So those muscles are there keeping your legs underneath your body. Those are really strong muscles. Okay, so, and as a matter of fact, your fingers, you can do this. What's that? Abduction and adduction. Okay, toes the same thing. All right, well, the shoulder joint, it's got a special kind of shape to it. It's called a ball and socket. And you saw that we can, what is this called? This is a tough one. What's this one? Flexion. Extension, hyperextension, and what's this? Yeah, that is abduction, adduction. The other thing the shoulder can do is called the rotation. All right, a rotation. Another way to think of a rotation is that joint between C1 and C2, So I can rotate my head. This is a left lateral rotation, right? And then here is a right lateral rotation. You can do the same thing with a shoulder joint. It's kind of hard to see. So the best way to, because you can't tell which way the humerus is pointing when you rotate it. So probably the best thing is do this at the elbow. What is that? That's flexion. Flex at the elbow, okay? And then move your hand so that it rotates immediately. Your elbow isn't rotating. What is rotating? Your humerus is rotating in the shoulder joint, right? So this is a medial rotation. Here is a lateral rotation of the humerus. And that's a pretty important kind of diagnostic procedure. There is something called a rotator cuff, which is a structure that makes the shoulder nice and strong, and it's easy to rip. It's called a rotator cuff tear. This is a typical kind of thing that somebody would use to diagnose a rotator cuff injury, is they say bend the elbow, do a medial rotation, and then they apply some pressure as you try to do a lateral rotation. And if you try really hard with a rotator cuff injury, you'll just scream in agony. So usually people can't press very hard that way. Lateral rotation, right? All right, so here's the shoulder. You can flex, extend, abduct, adduct, you can rotate. And if you do all of those things together in a motion, because it's a ball and socket joint, right, that's called circumduction. So circumduction is putting all those motions together to make like a windmill motion. Okay, and I see that here, circumduction, right, circumduction. All right, what other, we got a couple more motions, which are fun to talk about. Let's see what kind of pictures I have. Okay. Yes, the mandible. Okay, you all know where the mandible is. When you open your mouth, we call that depression, right? Because the mandible depresses. Or elevation when you close your mouth. There are different kinds of muscles for elevation and depression of the mandible. And remember that TMJ joint? Was that kind of a special joint? What did you remember about the TMJ, temporomandibular joint? It had that articular disc. Right, and not only can the TMJ depress and elevate, you can also, but don't crack a tooth when you do this, you can jut your mandible forward, you can stick it out, then you can bring it back. Okay, those are motions that we call protraction and retraction. Right, protraction is when you jut your jaw out. Can you see this mandible is a little bit now in front of the maxilla right here? Okay, or if you bring your jawbone back in, we call that retraction. So the mandible can protract and retract. And your shoulders can actually do that as well, right? Like protraction, retraction, protraction, retraction. Okay, protraction is an anterior motion. Okay, here's a pretty good one to know as well. All right, so which way do your thumbs face when you're in anatomic position? Laterally, right? Anatomic position, you're standing looking facing forward, hands down by your side, your thumbs are facing laterally. But what can you do with the palms of your hands? Right now they're facing anterior. You could get them, you can turn them so that they face posteriorly. My humerus is not rotating. Okay, what is happening is that the bone that's lateral, what bone is lateral? The radius, the lateral bone crosses over the ulna, and then it goes back. Crosses over, and it goes back. So that motion, so you make the palms of your hands face posteriorly, that is called pronation. Okay? And then if you move your hands so that the palms face anteriorly, that's called supination. Right, so that's when the ulna and radius cross over each other. That's why the interosseous membrane is not super strong. It allows for that kind of motion. All right, so how are you going to know which one is pronation versus supination? So right now, how do I have my hands? Pronated or supinated? Supinated. Put your hands together like that. Flex your fingers a little bit. What does that make? A soup bowl. Okay, so think of palms facing anteriorly. It can make a soup bowl.
How
Okay, now put it back down by your sides. Another way that I think I remember, if you take the palms of your hands and face it posteriorly, that is pronation. All those P's kind of line up, right? But it's really easy to remember supination. All right, so you might have a video in Blackboard about that. Opposition, okay, is when you can take your thumb, there's a special joint, you can move your thumb anterior to the palms of your hand. That's opposition, right? So you can flex and extend the thumb, but you can also do that opposition. That's a special joint for grasping. We're almost done. Got a couple other motions that are really good. Oh, we're going to get to that in a second. Here's one. Dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. This only refers to the ankle. If you point your toes into the ground, we call that plantar flexion. Like right now, I'm pointing my toes into the ground. And what is my body doing? My toes are lifting my whole body up. Okay. Or I could be standing in an anatomical position. I can lift my toes off the ground, like so. That is what we call dorsiflexion. All right, so we got plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. Which one requires stronger muscles? Plantar flexors or dorsiflexors? Stronger muscles are the ones that are going to raise my whole body up off the ground, right? Because I got to lift my whole body, right? And those are plantar flexors. Dorsiflexors only have to lift my toes off the ground. Those don't have to be very strong, right? So you'll see that's going to be important motion. And these are antagonistic motions, flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. And antagonism is a very important control system idea, right? When you have things that work in opposition or antagonistic to each other, what that means is that you have precise control and balance over some part of your body. So it might seem, if you have two systems that work against each other, that that would be bad. But in terms of control systems, when things are antagonistic to each other, that's really a very good thing to have. It means you have precise control and balance. So think of your car. There are two mechanisms in your car that are antagonistic to each other, but you would never think of driving your car without these two antagonistic motions or two antagonistic mechanisms. What are those two things in your car? Yeah, gas pedal, brake pedal, right? Gas pedal makes your car go, brake pedal makes your car stop. You got to have both to have what? Precise control and balance of your car. If you only had a gas pedal, right, you could drive home from work, but what would happen when you got home? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you can't stop, right? So you need both of those motions, right? So all of these motions give you precise control and balance over your body, just like your gas pedal and brake pedal. Dorsiflexion. Okay. Plantar flexion. Okay. One last one. If you look anteriorly at your foot, right, so we're looking right down somebody's toes, here is an axis of rotation, and here is, here's your big toe. Okay, is your big toe medial or lateral?
Medial.
And your little toe is? Lateral. All right, so what bone is this right here? This is the medial one in your leg. Medial is the tibia. The lateral one is going to be the fibula. So if you bend the ankle just like this, right, so that you stand, you try to stand on your fibula, right, so you're going to try to stand on the edge that your little toe is on. That's what we call inversion. And that's relatively easy to do. Okay, when I try to, I can even probably stand on my fibula because I've sprained my ankle so many times. Okay. That's an easy motion. You don't have a lot of ligaments that prevent that inversion. If you try to evert, like stand on the side of your foot that has the big toe, that's really difficult to do. Okay? You have a lot more ligaments that stabilize the ankle in that particular motion. So easy to invert, hard to evert, but if you ever evert your foot accidentally, that causes a lot more damage because you have a lot more tendons and ligaments holding things together. All right, so let me look at this list. We've got angular flexion, abduction, circumduction, rotation, supination, pronation, dorsi, plantar, inversion, eversion, protraction, retraction, elevation, depression. Oh, okay, we said elevation and depression of the mandible, opening and closing your mouth, but what about your shoulder? What's that? Elevation, here is depression. Okay, so that's another joint that you can do that with. Okay, we got to finish up next time by talking about some shapes of joints which allow these different motions to take place. Right, so the structure of a joint will determine what kind of motion that it can go through. All right, so signage sheet is going around someplace. Practice your motions sometime.